Jungle Boogie. We came back with Cornelius, Don Cornelius, introducing Kulin the Gang with Jungle Boogie because it is the heart in some ways of our conversation here we're about to have. We've been waiting to do this conversation for a while. She's in the studio now. We are here with Erica Blunt Danois, who is an award-winning journalist, writer, editor, and professor, author of Love, Peace, and Soul, behind the scenes of America's favorite dance show, Soul Train. At the classic moments. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good to be here. I saw you, your dance moves there with Pat Pan. Surprised
you. You can't, you know, got to hear that music. You just can't sit down.
I mean, you know. Exactly.
So this book is pretty interesting on so many levels because we don't think of Soul Train, as this huge cultural phenomenon, what it did to change the nation in many ways, what it represented that historical moment when it was started. But let's talk about your sojourn and tie that immediately in with what this meant to you and how you got into this.
No, I mean, I came to Soul Train as a fan, you know, like everybody else. I watched Soul Train on Saturday mornings at noon. We came inside. It was appointment TV in the days before we had DVRs and 5 million channels. So it was, you know, it was necessary for, you know, musical history. And, you know, I grew up in a musical household. My father was a DJ. And so we had, you know, a record collection. And Soul Train was just an extension of that. So we got to see those artists, some of them, for the first time, you know, on TV live. So I came to it as a fan. But then I started to find out this rich history, you know, that Don owned the show. He was one of the first, you know, black entrepreneurs to own a TV show. That, you know, it came out of, you know, his work at WVON as, you know, one of the black DJs there, you know, Wesley South and Roy Wood, who had, you know, been interviewing Martin Luther King and had, you know, participated in giving political activists a platform on the show. And so, you know, I just started to find out all of this other background history, then also the history of the show and all of these different things that Don attempted to do as an entrepreneur as well, from a record label to, you know, Soul Train nightclub where Richard Pryor, I just watched this documentary yesterday about Richard Pryor, and he recorded that N-word's crazy at the Soul Train nightclub.
Right.
So I just kept finding out all of this crazy information.
That they had to cut when they put it on television. They had to do all kinds of editing.
Yes, they did. Yeah, they had. He's hard to contain, however.
Hey, you know, Richard Pryor. But one of the things about this, you said something very important here. I mean, at the very beginning, you look at Don Cornelius, who started this Soul Train, his connection with the Johnson Empire.
Yeah.
You talk about in the book. You talk about how Dick Clark tried to buy it from him quickly because he was afraid of the competition.
Right.
I mean, this is amazing fact. A black man in that year, owning his own thing that exploded from a local TV show to this nationwide.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, that part alone, you know, from a business standpoint and from a TV standpoint is just amazing that he was able to do that. And it was really just from scratch in the way that, you know, I was thinking about like the, you know, the House of Cards and those kind of shows are really just doing it on their own. He was, you know, he said, I'm going to do it my way. So he, you know, because he was initially rejected from the three networks. And so he decided to create a pilot on his own and sell it.
But Johnson backed.
Black
and white version.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. So Johnson Products, Afro Sheen and Ultra Sheen Cosmetics, which my mom still uses.
You supposed to be saying that?
Hi, Mom. So, yeah, it was, you know, a very successful company and was one of the first black companies to be on the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, I talk about it in the book that Martin Luther King came to the offices of...
That's black power.
Yes, he said that's why he came to... So, yeah, I mean, that partnership allowed him to not have to worry about sponsorship in the South and... you know, which was the problem that Nat King Cole had with his show, that sponsors weren't ready to see a black host, and particularly a black host that owned his own show.
But the thing about this particular show, Soul Train, was the longest, as you write, the longest standing TV show ever, right?
Well, longest running first run syndicated show in history.
Okay, that's the line I couldn't get to.
It's a lot. It's a mouthful. Yeah.
but it came on the cusp of the end of the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
when black culture kind of exploded, in a sense, becoming the underpinning of American culture. That's what this kind of represented in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it definitely happened at the right time. So, you know, the Kerner Commission had come out where Lyndon Johnson was looking at what was the result, you know, what were the problems that precipitated the riots. And one of the problems was that there wasn't black representation on TV. There weren't black reporters covering the riots. There weren't black reporters covering what caused the riots. And so, you know, Don talked about how on the 6 o'clock news, you only saw negative images of black people. And so Bandstand was, you know, his real dream was to be a DJ. And so he felt that he can do, you know, have the passion for music on a TV show, and at the same time have, you know, this sort of political platform as well. You know, more subtly, but...
When you decided to take this project on, you found people like Demita Joe Freeman, one of the dancers who became a major figure in her own right.
Exactly, yes. Yes. The dancers were probably the most fun and the most really...
I forgot about Rosie Perez being one of the dancers,
yeah.
The actress.
Vivica
until I saw
Fox.
Your book. But I didn't think about those two things until your
yeah,
book. Well,
Vivica
that's
Fox.
Right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Nick Cannon. Like, yeah. I mean, a lot of people made careers out of being dancers on Soul Train. So, and they really had some of the most compelling stories because these were kids that weren't getting paid. And, you know, I talked to some who would take, you know, planes from New York to L.A. every 2 weeks to be on the show just and not getting paid. And, you know, a lot of them ended up doing very well. So Demita Joe Freeman was, she ended up choreographing for Mick Jagger and for Cher and ended up dancing alongside Rudolf Nureyev and for the Queen of England and, you know, just like...
She was trained as a dancer from a child on, but then...
As a classical ballerina.
About,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And she went on tour with James Brown, and there's some... Speaking of hot pants, there were some really funny anecdotes that she gave
James
me.
James had a way.
Yes, he did.
We'll leave it right there for the moment, but James had a way. One of the things I think that's important here, there are so many things important in this book, is that about what this show did. It launched so many careers. We forget that,
yeah.
As you write about, yeah. It wasn't just the old disco soul music of the early 70s
right. That
he helped explode and bring all these acts on that people forget every major act was there.
Exactly. And but minor hip-hop. Acts. Yeah.
And minor acts.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some of the behind-the-scenes stories, too, that, you know, he had hired people like Mark Warren from Laugh-In, like black executives behind the scenes as well. So Leo Sullivan, who was a cartoonist for Fat Albert, the Fat Albert kids.
Right. Cosby's Fat
yes,
Albert kids.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right.
So he made, Sid McCoy, who was a radio DJ, was the announcer. So... And he was a radio DJ. I just came back from Chicago, which he was a radio DJ at VON. And so, you know, they were black people that were hired behind the scenes. And, you know, he definitely employed people on every level.
And and the people, I didn't realize this really until your book, that some of the great young, some of the then young hip-hop artists exploded on the scene because of his show.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yes,
I mean, I didn't know any of that stuff. I mean, who were they? I'm going to get their names up here. I have them marked off.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Chuck D. I talked to Big Daddy Kane and Curtis Blow,
and they all came through Soul Train.
Soul Train. Yes, Soul Train was still that platform to get publicity to get exposure, even in the early 90s when there was competition from, you know, other sort of niche programs like, MTV and Rap City and those kind of shows on BET, Curtis Blow said he still felt like when he came to the studio and he was, you know, in the set, he said he felt like he had arrived, like he made it on Soul Train. And he, at the time, he had been touring internationally and had been, you know, had performed, opened for The Clash, and he said when he got home after being on Soul Train, he walked down 125th Street and everybody's like, oh my God, I saw you on Soul Train. And they, you know, he needed bodyguards after that.
and Don Cornelius was a very complex character.
Yes.
From the way you described him at the beginning, putting the show together, to the very end when Demeter Joe came to him for help.
Yeah.
He's a very complex, aloof, but deeply involved character. Very, very complex.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for him to succeed at the time period that he did and in the industry that he did, he had to sort of be that complex, you know, sort of standoffish, you know, aloof, and create sort of a persona that would allow him to survive in that kind of environment, I think. But when I met him in Chicago, I had pictured him as this, you know, really cool, like, you know, the clothes and the afro, like somebody I can, you know, go and hang out with. And he was really this, you know, really irreverent, just like blunt and sort of abrasive. In a way that was, you know, like...
Didn't expect it.
Yeah. And, I mean, I talked to, you know, people that were close to him, and it was clear that he was, that he sort of knew he was near the end. And so I think he sort of felt like he could say whatever he wanted to say, you know. He had, you know, he had suffered an aneurysm in the early 80s. And hadn't really been the same since then. So, you know, he had had seizures, and his eyesight was impaired, and, you know, incontinence, and a bitter, bitter divorce.
Yeah, there's a whole reason why he may have committed suicide. Nobody really knows. But
exactly.
But there was a lot that was going on in his life at the end.
From
being so high and creating this world that nobody ever had before on the air. I mean, it put Dick Clark to shame and others. It
really did. Yeah.
You know?
Coming from this really modest, you know, place. Like, I was in Chicago, and that local show was black and white. It was tiny. Like, the kids would come on the show, and they didn't have air conditioning. They would pass out from dancing. Like, it was, you know, really. And coming from that to where you're the longest-running, first-run syndicated show in history is...
What I was thinking about as reading this book, and by folks, we're talking today... because of this lecture you have coming up that we want to let people know about, but we want to do this in a longer way one day and really have a major Soul Train hour here with Erica.
With the Soul Train line, too? Or?
Hey, bring them on. I'll dance. Okay. But I might fall, but I'm old, so I might fall like Don Cornelius did, which is why he never did it again, as you wrote, right?
Yes.
He did the line and fell.
The first time he came down the line and the last time he came down the line.
But one of the things I thought about going through this book is that the period when this started was a period when Fat Albert began.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1975, whatever year that was, Roots happened.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The miniseries. And to me, there's a very significant piece here, I think, and Soul Train really started dawning me as I was looking at the book, that Soul Train was a significant part of. It was kind of the post-segregation explosion of black culture. I was going to say redefining American culture, but taking its place as one of the major definitions of American culture that was never allowed before. This was a significant moment in the 70s that Soul Train was at the center of.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that's also what's really interesting. It was this undiluted version of what black people were doing and, you know, their own private spaces. So, you know, whether it was kids dancing at rec centers or, you know, DJs talking in that rhyming style that they did, or artists being able to, you know, have a rapport with kids that, you know, that looked like them.
And they actually talked to the kids in the air. That was
exactly.
Go back and forth, which was great.
Right.
Which Don Cornelius allowed to happen.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So, and then having that on TV for people who hadn't seen it before. So it wasn't just black people, obviously, watching the show.
No.
This was
that's the whole thing. It wasn't just black people watching.
Yeah. In fact, there may have been more white people than black people watching the show as long as it did.
If you did an analysis, I'm sure more white people watched this than black people seeing it. That's just the nature of the commercial beast.
Exactly. So this was, you know, for some people, the first time they got to see black culture on TV.
I think this book to me is for you. It seems to be like the beginning of a very important sojourn, and looking at a part of our history that we don't think of, because we don't take this seriously because it's entertainment history. But that is us.
Exactly. Exactly. And entertainment is always the route to get to other, you know, more serious issues. I mean, he used that as a venue to talk, you know, to have people like Terry Wallace, who wrote a book about black Vietnam veterans, on the show. He, you know, gave, you know, Marsha Warfield a platform. Cheech and Chong came on the show. You know, he had Reverend Al Sharpton as a 17-year-old kid.
Who was like a James Brown protege at that time.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes, yes, because James Brown's son, Teddy.
He has that conk because...
In honor of James Brown. Yes,
right?
Yes,
right.
Yes, still today.
Still today. he says he keeps the conk because...
Exactly, yeah. So, and, you know, Reverend Jesse Jackson had, you know, a platform on the Chicago version every day to talk about PUSH and Operation Breadbasket. So,
there was a political social nature of the show is what you're saying.
Yeah,
right?
Which I didn't know either, because I watched as a kid to learn how to do the dances and to see my, you know, favorite artist. So I didn't know that, you know, and even the Scramble Board and, you know, teaching... you know, the question was, you'll have to unscramble these letters to, you know, name a famous person in black history. And so, you know, every episode they had to, you know, unscramble. And so and the Afro-Sheen commercials, you know, with representing, you know, natural hair. And so there was, you know, there were political messages underneath.
And now this is interesting. All this is owned by Magic Johnson, as you write about in this book as well. That he owns.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of different people that have invested in it. So Magic Johnson is one of those people. And then is Soul Train Holdings LLC. So it's a.
Are they the ones who allowed you to use the pictures?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did.
You have some great pictures in here.
Yeah.
Great photos.
They have a whole warehouse of pictures that I wish that you could just...
So this is much too short. We're going to make this a lot longer, but you have to come in studio to do it.
Okay.
I'm not doing a phoner.
Oh, yeah. Now we got to do the Soul Train.
That's exactly.
Yeah, it's necessary.
Erica Blandt-Danois will discuss and sign copies of Love, Peace, and Soul behind the scenes of America's favorite dance show, Soul Train, Classic Moments, 2 o'clock this Saturday, February the 15th. Won't be snowing. That's tomorrow, so you can get down there. 2 o'clock this Saturday, February the 15th, at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture, 830 East Pratt Street. More information at 443-263-1800 or rflewismuseum.org. What do you want to say?
Also, I have a video that we're going to show that shows some of the clips that haven't been seen since their first run of the show. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it should be fun for folks who feel nostalgic and...
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is really, I mean, you're a good writer.
Let me tell you that.
You really are a good writer.
Oh, thank you.
I don't throw that out lightly. You're a good writer.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I think this is, I really, you've got me on a sojourn in this book in terms of what it really says about American culture and then how the early 70s, which is sometimes a much maligned era, began to transform who we are as a nation without us even knowing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Civil rights and then also even television history and where we are today in terms of, you know, he paved the way for, you know, BET networks and TV
and
One. And even, you know, like I said, the Netflix shows.
Oh. You see what they're saying?
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Erica Blandt-Danois, thank you so much. See you Saturday, 2 o'clock, Reginald F. Lewis Museum.
All right.
Go down there.
Okay.
Love, peace, and soul.
Bring your hot pants. Okay.
All right. I'm not wearing hot pants, baby. I'm not doing that.
All right.
So good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having me.
We're going to take a very short break and come back with our weekly look at what's going on in the city paper. Going out with Ecstasy, Barry White, who sang this on Soul Train. Barry White. Your love, baby. No, baby. Well, if I could only make you see.